This is Where We Meet, sharing conversations from New Mexico and beyond. I'm Chelsea Reedy, and this show is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Taos Center for the Arts would like to recognize that it operates on the homelands of the Red Willow people of Taos Pueblo. We'd like to honor the ongoing importance of Native and Indigenous cultures within our community and within the land we live, learn, and exist on. On today's show, we speak to Dr. Philip Gonzalez, a doctor in sociology at the University of New Mexico, about his historical and sociological work on Nuevo Mexicanos and Northern New Mexico. Much of our discussion focuses on the time period between the mid-19th century and early 20th century when New Mexico was acquired by the United States from Mexico. Dr. Gonzalez's work explores ethnic identities and politics that were experienced by Mexican descendants after 1848. In this first part, Dr. Gonzalez reads an excerpt from his work about Diego Archuleta. Gonzalez describes Nuevo Mexicanos who were engaged in politics and working towards New Mexico statehood in the 19th century.
So during this period when Nuevo Mexicanos were so engaged in the politics of the territory back in the 19th century, and I should emphasize that these were territorial possessions all over the West in those days. And they may not have been states, but their politics could be just as competitive, just as organized, and just as significant, mainly because the denizens of the territories wanted to become a state. And so one of the ways that they felt they could demonstrate to Congress that they were ready for statehood was to show that they could carry on a politics of democracy and representative government, and to be able to write constitutions for their particular territories. So there were scores of Nuevo Mexicanos who were engaged in this whole process, and when they died, many of the preeminent among them were given tributes in the press. And among leaders later on in the century. One of them was Diego Archuleta, who was a very, very important leader in northern New Mexico. He represented Rio Arriba County, but he also had a very important constituency in Taos itself. And so this is what I say about him and his passing. Diego Archuleta died of heart failure in 1884 at age 70, an active player of the entire annexation experience of New Mexico. He was remembered as a bitter opponent of the 1846 American occupation of New Mexico, and at the same time as an intense patriot of the United States later on. The Rio Arriba and Taos County Don served 45 consecutive years in public service for two national sovereigns. He was a member of the Territorial Assembly when he died. Having taken ill while on the floor of the House, he rallied himself from bed to register his vote on an important bill. As the Santa Fe newspaper recorded, he was still very weak and returned to his room immediately after casting his vote. The utmost care and attention was shown him, and every treatment known to medical skill was brought to bear. But despite all efforts, he continued to sink and grew worse until death came to his relief at an early hour, whence came the beautiful and peaceful close of an honored and busy official life.
That was Dr. Philip Gonzalez. We're talking to Gonzalez about his historical and sociological work on Nuevo Mexicanos and Northern New Mexico during the 19th century, when New Mexico was acquired by the United States from Mexico. One of Dr. Gonzalez's publications include Politica, Nuevo Mexicanos and American Political Incorporation, 1821 to 1871. This was published in 2016 from the University of Nebraska Press. Here's the conversation. I'd like to start off with talking about a term. Our conversation today is going to focus on your historical and sociological work around Nuevo Mexicanos and Northern New Mexico. But I wonder if we can start by really inspecting the layers of the term Nuevo Mexicano and what it means.
Basically, Nuevo Mexicanos, at least from the perspective that I'm accustomed to, and which is a viewpoint that is shared by my academic colleagues around the country is that the term refers to a section of Mexican Americans, but it attains some significance as a distinct category by virtue of the fact that so much of the history of Mexican Americans is broken up into actually histories of regions. And so when the Southwest was incorporated into the United States, or when the United States conquered the Southwest and brought California, Texas, and New Mexico within the scope of its state borders, what happened is that the experiences within the American society of the Californians, of the Tejanos, and of the Nuevo Mexicanos was quite distinct. Each one of these went through some pretty unique experiences. The contrast that I like to make is with that of African Americans and slavery. So that slavery was an institution that spanned the South as a whole. Of course, there were variations in the organization of slavery among the states. Nevertheless, there was that definition of African Americans by virtue of their connection to the institution of slavery. The parallel did not occur in the Southwest. That is, there was no overarching structure that would have connected the Californios and the Mexicanos and the Tejanos, all of whom were former citizens of Mexico. So that, for example, Texas became a state in 1845. California became a state in 1850. New Mexico didn't become a state until 1912. So that means that there were enough particular experiences connected to each one of these subcategories of Mexican Americans to justify using the terms Californio, Nuevo Mexicano, and Tejano. And in the case of the Nuevo Mexicanos, their distinct history had a linear extension clear until from 1848, when New Mexico became a part of the United States, clear until 1910, when immigration from Mexico started to really become significant.
And I think one of the things that you write about, well, let's go there to 1848, and with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and what is known today as New Mexico being acquired by the United States from Mexico. And I think one of the things that you write about or inspect is that a lot of folks went from identifying as Mexican to Nuevo Mexicano, which aligned them with Spain rather than Mexico. And I think that one part of your writings kind of explore that shift in identity or that choice of identity and why that's there. And really why this denial of Mexican ancestry here, like within New Mexico, that exists. And I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd be glad to. And in fact, this is a topic. This is a topic that I first addressed in my first publication. Actually, it's just ending my term as a graduate student, and my first publication had to do with the Spanish heritage in New Mexico. And I would have never imagined that so many decades later I would still have an interest in it. But in fact, I do.
Why is that, do you think? What sustains the interest?
Well, for one thing, I thought that I was going to get done with it in short order, but I got interrupted by other topics and I never was able to really complete it. And so now I'm working on a manuscript and on a book that's going to revisit the origins of Spanish American identity in New Mexico. There has been quite a bit written on this topic, and there is what can be considered a canon in the historical and social science literature about when it began, what it meant to the Nuevo Mexicanos, and also the Euro-Americans who came into the United States and did a great deal to promote the whole identity complex, how it functioned, and the underlying sort of causes of it. My sense is that there's a lot to be learned from that literature. Folks have done some very interesting original research that ties a lot of general New Mexico history to the emergence and the promotion and the expansion of this identity complex. I still feel that there are a lot of things yet to be uncovered. And so I'm going back to its origins during the period that New Mexico was part of Mexico, because the roots go that far back. There's a tendency in the literature to say that there was a kind of social psychological reaction to American racism that came in at the turn of the 20th century, the late 19th century and the early 20th century, and that is, it was in response to anti-Mexican feelings by Euro-Americans who were coming in from Texas and from Oklahoma, or they were building a tourist industry and they wanted to create a sense of tricultural harmony, and that this was these were the triggers for the sense that no Mexicanos developed that, oh, well, we're really Spanish, not Mexican. And emphasizing the dissociation from Mexicans, especially with the start of the Mexican Revolution in 1910, when they were coming in much higher numbers than before, and which was leading to some anti-Mexican sentiments. So, but I think that shortchanges the historical development of the sense of the Spanish heritage and how it figured into New Mexican identity. And so I'm going back and I'm tracing it to one element within what I call the process of nomenclaturing, the process of naming oneself.
Yeah.
And throughout much of the 19th century, there were a number of nomenclatures that were being utilized by the Nuevo Mexicanos. Basically, my major premise is going to be that what was really involved here was the search among a Nuevo Mexicano intelligentsia to establish a sense of primacy on New Mexico soil. I'm going to be making the argument that what Spanish identity reflected was a sense of ethnic nationalism, regional ethno-nationalism. This movement in the public discourse of the New Mexico Territory to establish the case that we are sons of this soil was one that went back all the way to, about 1850.
I think one of the things that we found in your work is really looking at the, and during that time, meaning kind of that 1850s to 1950s, kind of this ethnic distribution of power that New Mexico faced when becoming part of the United States. And I wonder if you could describe that a little bit and tell us about what that looked like.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Other researchers have pointed out the importance of the struggle for statehood in the generation and the promotion of Spanish American identity. And the one who has done the most is my friend John Nieto Phillips, who's devoted practically a whole book to this whole topic. John is among, those researchers who have pointed out some very important developments, some very important forces that stimulated the whole option of identifying as Spanish. One way of putting it is that, the Nuevo Mexicanos were under pressure to show their whiteness, and that the people of the United States, including members of Congress, were not about to accept a bunch of, mixed blood, mongrel, quasi-Indian Mexicans into our nation. And so therefore, Nuevo Mexicanos were sort of compelled to say, no, we're white. See, we have Spanish blood. Well, that's not wrong. It's not wrong, but it's incomplete. And so And so the whole question of statehood in relationship to New Americano primacy has its theoretical link in terms of internal colonialism. Let me try to say this very quickly and say that many internally colonial regional folks went in the direction of trying to separate out from the master state that has colonized them. Others have gone in the direction of federalism, like the French in Canada, where they are given power over their own homeland, you know, and they figure into the federalism of the master state. There's another option, though, that has been identified in the social science literature, and that is called subnational constitutionalism. And what happens there is that rights are granted to the internally colonized group by virtue of the constitution within the particular federal unit that encompasses their homeland. And that is exactly what happened in the case of New Mexico. And so the rights that were granted to the Nuevo Mexicanos in the state constitution of 1910 is a perfect example of subnational constitutionalism. So there's that political motivation that has been missing in the examination of the importance of statehood for Nuevo Mexicano identity.
So in the news magazine of the American Historical Association, you were asked, what was the most fascinating thing that you've ever found at the archives or while doing research? And you've referred to learning that Nuevo Mexicanos controlled the territorial politics of New Mexico between 1853 and 1905, where there was a working U.S. Republican government in Spanish. And I wonder if you could expand on that.
Yes. Yeah, So my book, Politica, one of the major points it makes is that, in fact, Nuevo Mexicanos may have been conquered after after the Mexican-American War. But when the Congress established New Mexico as a federal territory, what began was a process of political integration in which Nuevo Mexicanos were, in fact, in control of the territorial politics. It was pretty incredible. And it goes against what had been the claim begun by a famous, you know, Southwestern historian that in fact Nuevo Mexicanos knew nothing about American politics, that they knew nothing about political parties, and that, you know, and implying that it was a small number of Anglos or Euro-Americans who control the politics of the territory. It is completely in error. Mm-hmm. And so that, for example, the top elective office was the delegate to Congress from the territory. Well, Nuevo Mexicanos did that position for some 35, 40 years before there was a whole new process of inequality that began once the railroad came into New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that I consider a major contribution in the work that I have done is to show just how knowledgeable former Mexicans the knowledge that they attained to be able to negotiate their way through what was an American system of Republican government.
And I think, well, you tell me, I feel like this relates, one of the phrases that I came upon in some of your articles and work that I was unfamiliar with was cultural citizenship. And I think really, like, you know, how I think that's probably used in scholarship often. But I wonder if we can talk about cultural citizenship in the context of this discussion about this period of time.
So cultural citizenship is a concept that was developed by a good friend of mine, anthropologist Renato Rosaldo. And he and his colleagues examined how it is, and we're talking about, you know, current day ethnic circumstances in which pockets or communities of Mexican origin folks in the United States held on to their traditional cultures and still were able to function within the context of the within the greater American civil discourse, in the context of the greater American democracy. So it's this ability to be able to retain tradition and live in a modern society that is at the crux of cultural citizenship. Well, you know, during this period that we're talking about here, it's just incredible that, you know, No Mexicanos conducted popular elections. They ran a territorial legislature. They campaigned in when the election time season came, totally in Spanish, completely in Spanish. And in fact, if you were an English-speaking immigrant from the States coming in and settling in New Mexico, you damn well better learn to speak Spanish, or you were going to be left out of the civic, the political, and even the economic ballgame. So that can be seen as an example of cultural citizenship.
And I think you give in the article Loyalty Question, Nuevo Mexicanos in the Great War, I think you paint this picture of just kind of, I think, right when war was starting and declared. And actually, right over here, near Taos Center for the Arts, TCA, is where the Kit Carson Cemetery is. And you paint this picture, and I can't remember the details, but it's a picture of the gathering of the citizens and kind of a display of nationalism and in support, you know, of the United States happening here, but in Spanish. And is that an example of what you were talking about?
Yes, and that was very important, because that was a speech that was given by one of the Taos No Mexicano leaders promoting American patriotism.
Right.
There was no contradiction between being a native No Mexicano, Catholic, Spanish-speaking, with the old rituals, mm-hmm. And the old beliefs and customs, and being loyal to the United States. It was when New Mexico was becoming a state, and you had so many American white nationalists who were saying, these folks are Mexican, and so therefore they cannot belong to this nation. They totally, you know, were ignorant of the fact that for decades, No Mexicanos had been practicing and reproducing American democracy for so long. And they were attached to the United States. Mexico was not making any gestures to try to bring these people back in. And they were not interested in going back to Mexico. A little bit of ironic there, given the fact that they were in fact conquered. But they saw their future as vested in participation and belonging to the American nation.
So one of the things I was thinking about was, and you as a scholar, and a lot of your work is rooted in research and looking at history and looking at the historical record. And I'm assuming that there's obviously significant meaning and value that you associate with how history affects our lives and our social fabric now. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that kind of in a specific way for your life, or for your community's life today?
On my father's side, I am long-term No Mexicano. My father was born and raised in a village along the upper Pecos Valley called Sena, in the San Miguel del Vado land grant. Sena, New Mexico, was settled about 1793, and it was by families who had come over from Santa Fe. So on that side of my, my personal heritage, I'm No Mexicano to the core, or I should say to half the core, because on my mother's side, my mother was born in El Paso in 1922 to a family that was migrating into the United States at the end of the Mexican Revolution. And so my oldest aunt, my tia Flora, was born in Mexico, but my mom and her other siblings were born in El Paso. They migrated up. My grandparents settled in Belen. My mother was raised in Belen, went through the public schools in Belen, New Mexico. So, you know, I like to tease my friends and tell them that I am half Spanish and half Mexican. But you know, so I've got both of those strains, and it is one of the factors that justifies, you know, categorizing Nuevo Mexicanos as Mexican Americans, because there were those pockets in New Mexico in the late 19th century, but going on into the 20th century, in which Nuevo Mexicanos were being displaced from their land, and Mexicanos were coming up, and they were meeting, and they were becoming friends, and they were, we could call it intermarrying, but they were marrying among themselves. Mm-hmm. Well, my grandparents lost their land in Sena, and my grandfather became a miner. He goes up to Terreros, up in the Pecos Mountains, to become a miner. And there, my father used to talk about how he used to ride his horse up and down the mounds of Pecos, which are now under threat of forest fire. But when the mine closed, because the workers went on strike, they went to the Grants area. And Grants Gallup area was one of those places where Nuevo Mexicanos and Mexicans coming north came together, and they created families. So when I see Nuevo Mexicanos who react against the protests against the Oñate statue, there's some resonance there. You know, I consider myself Mexican American more than anything else. So a Nuevo Mexicano. Then there's some resonance to those who consider themselves so deeply embedded in the New Mexico as a state, that it reflects, you know, my own heritage on my father's side. But the importance of immigration from Mexico is also part of my heritage too. And so when some of those issues come up, then I feel like, you know, that's part of my family's experience. And so, you know, I can identify with both of these major trends in Mexican-American history.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Sure thing. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Where We Meet comes from Taos Center for the Arts in Taos, New Mexico, and is supported by the National Endowment for the Humanities. Producers include Colette LaBeouf, Chelsea Reedy, Elise Morion, Ariana Cubillos-Vogler, and Joshua Aragon. Research and writing by Jack and Paul. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. On Where We Meet, we share conversations from New Mexico and beyond. Thanks for listening. Be well.